Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who is joining us here for our weekly show here on Brighteon TV, The Tenpenny Files on Your Health. For the last 23 years or so, I've given literally thousands of interviews on radio, TV, podcasts, conferences, and all those things, and almost all my information was in one way or another about vaccines. But with decades of medical training and experience, there are so many more things to talk about. That's why I started this show on your health. Tonight, my special guest is the one and only wonderful friend, long-term friend of mine, Andy Wakefield. Before I introduce him, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out. The heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch with in our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years. Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off. Well, welcome back, everyone. Thank you for being here with us tonight. Dr. Andy Wakefield is a physician, author, filmmaker. He graduated as a fellow from the Royal College of Surgeons in 1985 and made his fellow of Royal College of Pathologists in 2001. He has published over 150 original articles, books, book chapters, and scientific commentaries. While examining a possible link between childhood vaccines, intestinal inflammation, and neurological injury in children, he lost his job at the Department of Medicine in London at the Royal Free and Hospital, and his country, his career, his fellowships, and eventually lost his medical license. Andy reinvented himself as an author, writing two books, including the national bestseller, Callous Disregard, now optioned for a feature film, and he also even more remade himself as a filmmaker. He's produced and directed and co-wrote the movie Vaxxed, From Cover Up to Catastrophe, a CDC whistleblower's story confirming that vaccine autism link, and one of the top U.S. documentaries featured in 2016. In 2020, he released the 1986 The Act, a docudrama story of corruption behind liability protection for vaccine manufacturers. I've seen that documentary twice. I know the story, and I cry all the way through it every single time I've seen it, because it is such a compelling way to put it together. If you haven't seen it, you really must. His most recent film, just released, is the third and a major narrative feature called Protocol 7, co-written with Terry Rossio, who also wrote Aladdin, Shrek, and Pirates of the Caribbean. Protocol 7 is based on a real-life events of Alexis Koprowski, a devoted mother and small-town family lawyer, Adrian Joy, a renegade doctor exiled from the medical profession, and Steve Schilling, a virologist at a prominent vaccine laboratory turned corporate whistleblower. They work together to hold a large pharmaceutical corporation, in this instance, Merck, accountable for allegedly the fraudulent testing that was behind the failed mumps vaccine. Protocol 7 takes us behind the scenes of the corporate curtain, exposing a chain of command, prioritizes profits over people, fosters an amoral mindset of just following the orders. And man, Andy and I have known about that for decades. The website is protocol7.movie, where you can find more about showtimes, watch the trailer, and subscribe to their newsletter. Andy, welcome so much to the Tenpenny Files on Your Health. I am so honored to have you here and see you again, my friend. It's been far too long since we've been together.
Sherry, it's great to be back. Thanks so much.
Yeah, so I have to start by saying you must feel so vindicated for getting this film out and for the accolades and everything that it's gotten. I've read three Substacks just today, just accolades after accolades, applauding you, applauding the film, your heroism, and everything that you've done. You've got to feel so vindicated to get this out.
It's vindication. It's an interesting thing. I feel that there is justice is in sight for the children who've been put in harm's way, the families that have been lied to, even the doctors that have been lied to when they administered this vaccine. I mean, it goes back a long way, Sherry, as you know, and you've very kindly told my story on your show before. But I've always had a major problem with the safety profile of MMR vaccine. And it was in lecturing about these concerns that a whistleblower came to me many years ago when, in fact, when Autism One was still in downtown Chicago before
Wow.
we moved out to the airport hotel.
I
And
remember that.
yes, indeed. And it was an extraordinary story. And in those days, when people would come to me as whistleblowers, I would hand it over to class action lawyers or to lawyers with a particular interest in this kind of subject to be handled according to its merits. And then I lost my career and I decided to become a filmmaker and turn some of these stories into movies. They're classic feature films in the genre of Erin Brockovich or Silent Spring or Spotlight. People loves whistleblower stories. And this here we have a story based on a true story. It's a combination of those true events with fictional events. We including, for example, the lawyer Alexis Kaprowski. It's really the story of a mother's love and her intuition pitched against the power of this corporate giant. And her role is really an amalgam of all of the mothers that I've met and spoken to, the thousands and thousands of mothers that I've met and spoken to over the years dealing with autism. And so her story, her persona is a constellation that sort of pays tribute to all those mothers.
You know, I love in the trailer that I've seen so far, because I haven't seen the full release yet, but I love in the trailer where she's sitting in that, I think in a room in a lawyer, like a lawyer's office, doing a deposition, and just the look on her face of, yeah, I gotcha, is just so impeccable. And it's so good, and it speaks for loudly. I'm sure that all of the mothers, just like what you said, that will be watching that, will be standing up in their chair and applauding.
She does that so well, doesn't she? Rachel Whittle was someone who was just on the verge of giving up acting. She
Oh,
was
really?
she had fallen foul of the demands for COVID vaccination or the COVID shots for actors to even be considered in casting, let alone getting the role. I mean, it really was so coercive, and she decided not to. Then she saw this film, which clearly made no such stipulation. It was a non-union film, and people could come to us vaccinated or unvaccinated. And so she applied. We had 2,500
Wow.
young women apply for that and to be cast for that. And she won. And she plays that role very, very well. That subtle understatement where the power of the corporate legal team that think they're going to crush this girl from, the sticks, and she just reels them in, and then, I won't ruin the story.
That was so good. What was that like, Andy? I mean, going through 2,500 applications, did you actually interview that many, or how many were actually interviewed, or what do they call it when they read for a position like that?
You
How many
ask them
actually
just.
did it?
You send them sides, which are scenes abstracted from the screenplay, and you send those to them, and then they send you back a recorded
Oh.
interpretation of those. So we have a casting agent who goes through those as well and sifts it down. And it comes down in the end to a few hundred that you really want to take very seriously. And then it's a process. It's a long process because, of course, you do that for every actor.
Yes.
Certainly every actor in a major role. And so it's a process, but it's so important. It's so important to get the right person for the role. And we were very fortunate in that respect.
You know, I heard you say in another interview that you actually wrote this storyline in 2012. And I think that in other interviews, you've kind of alluded to this MMR, you know, documentary. What was it like to produce something that's been in your mind for so long that you could actually see it? Like it's been like being pregnant for 10 years and then you can suddenly see it start to unfold and become a reality.
You're right. It's a long time. What I tried to do was give it enough time to play out in court. But that has to be balanced against the harm being done to a population that is still being lied to and is still being exposed to a defective vaccine that not only doesn't protect them, but makes the disease more dangerous. Why? Because mumps, as you know, is a trivial disease in children, but a much more serious disease in adults. And so if a vaccine doesn't work, or only works for a certain length of time, then you're going to accumulate a susceptible population of teenagers and young men and women who then get exposed and are at risk, much greater risk of testicular inflammation, ovarian inflammation, infertility. So it's a balance. It came to the point where this had been in court so long and stalled and this and that and the other and going back and forth that I said, no, this my duty is to the public and this film has to get out there. And so, and what's unusual about this film, Sherry, you'll appreciate this, is that films in this genre, like Erin Brockovich, the crime is committed, or The Insider, the tobacco industry expose. The crime is committed, it comes to a congressional hearing or a court case, a book or books get written, and then the film gets made. And here we are making a film right in the heat of battle, right in the middle of the litigation, which is now in the appeal court. And many of the documents that we didn't have access to because they were sealed, they were under seal from the court, are now being released to us. And when you read them, of course, you think, oh no, this is going to completely undermine our story. We're going to be guilty of defamation, and we either can the film or we're going to get sued. But it quite the opposite. When we went through these documents in great detail, we realized that the misdemeanors on behalf of Merck were far greater than we'd actually represented in the film. And so
Wow. We
felt very confident that this film will withstand any kind of legal scrutiny.
Why is it still in the courts, and why has it taken so long?
It's taken so long because you can delay these things. You can file motions for summary judgment. You can file motions for dismissal. And every technique that could be used appears to have been used. In the end, and this is why the film is so important, the judge was replaced. The original judge was replaced. And the new judge who came in, both sides filed a motion for summary judgment, saying our case is strong enough to either win, there was fraud, and this is what happened, or on the other hand, Merck's lawyers filing saying, no, we're right. And the judge found in favor of Merck, not because the fraud didn't happen, because of materiality. Now, what is materiality? Materiality is it didn't matter. What they're saying, what the evidence, what the Merck's counsel were saying is, so if they committed fraud or not, that doesn't matter because the government, the CDC, went on purchasing the vaccine. The CDC said, we didn't know about this. This was something that you were dealing with the FDA about. We didn't know about this. We were defrauded. But that argument didn't prevail because they're all part of the same government. So they said, we only had one option, that was MMR vaccine. We had to protect children. This was their argument. We had to protect children against measles and rubella. And since there is only MMR and no single vaccines, we had no choice but to purchase, to continue to purchase the Merck product, which had a monopoly in this country. And that the judge didn't buy into that either. Now, the interpretation of materiality by the judge was wrong. And many friends in the legal arena have looked at this and said, no, this was wrong and it's gone to appeal. It's very likely to be overturned at appeal. And then it'll get very interesting because it then gets set down for a jury trial. Merck, I do not believe Merck want this to go to a jury trial at all.
I'm sure they do not.
You know how juries handle this kind of thing. So it's going to be a very interesting journey from here on. But on the basis that this story would otherwise never get to the public, it may be a short paragraph on page 5 of the New York Times, and the public would never know that they had been so badly deceived, that their children had been put at risk. That is what makes this film so important.
Well, it would be interesting for as a jury selection nowadays, particularly after COVID, and people, for the most part, are more and more, and I hate the term waking up, but becoming more aware of the damage and the carnage that has been caused by this thing. And now that the Ninth Circuit has said, well, it's not even a vaccine, so it can't even have that kind of protection, we're in for some really interesting times legally of when people start bringing forth their suits. And for people to say that they don't know about autism, or they haven't heard anybody, or they don't know anybody in their family or friends that haven't had a child that is autistic, and it would be a really interesting jury selection to be able to even have a jury trial.
Yes, it would, wouldn't it? I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but it's so prevalent now that everybody knows someone or has someone.
Yeah, autism is like 1 in 34 or something. I mean,
in the UK, it's now 1 in 20 to 1 in 25. In Scotland, Ireland, and England. I've no doubt that America is the same. I've no reason to doubt that it's the same. I think ascertainment may be different and therefore or more complete there. But that's the kind of number we're approaching, is 1 in 20.
Are we going to get to the point, you know, Stephanie Seneff projected this, you know, years ago, one of the papers that she wrote, when you and I were both still talking about I'm still talking about it, but you were on the speaking circuit too. And Dr. Stephanie Seneff wrote a paper saying that 2030, that it was going to be 1 in 2, 50% of all children were going to be autistic or on the spectrum somewhere. And what does that do to all of our industries? I mean, the military, the post office, everybody, if we don't have any workers, because half of them are brain damaged.
Yes, and I think you and I both appreciate that medicine doesn't operate in a dichotomy. It's not you have autism or you don't. There are degrees of injury in between. So if you let, for example, just shave 9 points off the IQ of every person in America, every child in America, every baby born, what impact would that have on your ability to recruit people, even at the level of private, into the armed services, or recruit people into the police force? It would be profound. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing lesser degrees of injury that nonetheless compromise the population's ability to function cognitively or behave normally or respond normally. Or as we have previously understood normality. And it's really, really worrying.
Very worrying. So with this film, because the focus is on the mumps disease, I've only seen the trailer, does it incorporate anything about measles or with rubella, or is it purely about the fraud with the mumps vaccine?
It's about the fraud of the mumps vaccine. So it's almost less about the specific vaccine than just the behavior, the corporate behavior.
I see.
In respect of one of their flagship vaccines, the MMR. So you could, I imagine, just delete mumps and put in any other shot you like.
For sure.
behavior is the same, and what we intend by the film is to portray as accurately as we possibly can their behavior and their willingness to put their stockholders, their share price, their income before the well-being of the children of this country. That's what became abundantly apparent to me as I went through all of these documents.
So what's your plan for distribution, Andy? How are we, the consumer, going to get to be able to see the full film, not just the trailer?
Right. It's played now, had its premieres in New York and Austin, which was our sort of homecoming. This is where it was filmed. And then that was on Friday night. That was a wonderful, wonderful event. And now it moves to Los Angeles on Friday to play at the Lemley Theatre. And then it will have an extended run at the Lemley Theatre after the premiere. And then we go, this is where we get into the mainstream, Sherry. We have been picked up by Regal Cinemas across America and by Cineplex in Canada. So
wow.
That's really
huge.
That's huge. And we hope to pick up more theaters and more dates for the film once they see how popular it is. So then I would imagine what they tend to require, the movie theaters say, we want a month in which to have this exclusively in theaters, not for the, you know, Regal to be exclusive, but to have it in theaters as opposed to online. And then you go to online video on demand so people can get it just like they can get any other film. And if they go, they'll be able to access the film. Firstly, they'll be able to access the information about when the film will go on video on demand online. And then they will be able to access the film on Protocol 7.movie.
Oh, I can't wait for that to happen. I remember back in the days, when was it that the Vaxxed film was actually made? That was a long time ago. And you had to scrape to get, you know, small local theaters to house it. And, you know, there would be all kinds of revolts. And I remember we had question and answer periods. Now to the local theaters here, I went down and was one of the Q&A people for all of that. What a change in venue. And much more, like you said, you know, really mainstream. And I think that maybe Sound of Freedom sort of opened the door for that, that people are wanting to see meaningful, realistic things, which is exactly in the wheelhouse of where this film Protocol 7 falls.
You're absolutely right. So Vax was made in sort of 2014 through to 2016 and then screened. And we had all kinds of problems. Initially, we got into Tribeca, and then we were censored from Tribeca, and then the Houston Film Festival called us and said, we don't censor, you can come and play at the Houston Film Festival, you're going to be our special guest. So the next thing we heard is the mayor had threatened to pull a grant from the Houston Film Society.
Wow.
We're banned from Houston as well, despite all these protestations, and it came from, you know, the mayor's wife involved, her involvement in public health. And it's so difficult. Anyway, it got through to many, many people, and it's still selling very, very well. But it's a different world now. And I think one of the reasons it's different is, you pointed out, Sound of Freedom was a meaningful film. It wasn't just entertainment. It actually mattered. Yeah, and these are films that matter, that people care about. And when they go there, and I learned this first with Vax, people had thought for years they were on their own. They were isolated. This was their problem. And they were a sort of almost outcast, social outcast in the world. When they went to the movie, it was packed with people who spoke the same language, who had experienced the same tragedy of autism within their families. And so there was a tremendous camaraderie. There was a great feeling of unity that brought the community together for a long time. It was a very interesting experience. And my hope, of course, is that this will do the same thing. The other thing is that theaters need people.
For sure.
After COVID, they were shut down. Everybody they watched everything on Netflix. They watched everything on Max and everything else. that would became the norm for how people, certainly generations younger than I am, would see movies, even on their phones. They missed out on the magic of going to see it on the big screen with an audience who, you know, were equally as interested as they were. And that and COVID really had a major role in that, because it shut the theaters down because of this whole social distancing issue, and the theaters want to get people back, and they need movies that can do that.
Yeah, and I think meaningful movies is kind of the realm where people are going. You know, it's one thing to go to a movie and it's like a major a film that's like all imaginary. But I think that the most part, people really want to have, so if they're going to spend their time and their money, they're going to go there and they're going to eat the junk food. they need to do it for a meaningful reason. Well, Andy Wakefield, hold your thought right there for just a minute. We're going to take a really quick break. We're going to be right back. We're having a great discussion today with Andy Wakefield, physician, author, filmmaker, and my friend that I'm proud to say is my friend, about his new film that's just been released called Protocol 7. We will be right back. There are an awful lot of people that are affiliates for Mike Lindell, because we all really appreciate what he does for this country. We appreciate the hard work that he does, and we appreciate his products. He has more than 200 products in his store, everything from pillowcases and comforters to doggy beds and to wonderful slippers and bathrobes. There's something for everybody, and something for everybody in each age group. I mean, one of the things that I really like a lot are the pillowcases, the children's Bible story pillowcases, that I just think are such a great way when you tuck your child into bed at night to use these pillowcases, that they come from his store to start to tell the story about Adam and Eve and Noah and the Ark and different things. And they're colorful and they're really pretty. So from children all the way up to your gentlemen that want to have like nice slippers, or to your dog, the doggy beds and things are just wonderful. So my pillow is a great place to shop for just about anything that you want. And if you use our affiliate code DRT, that helps us, that can benefit us, that helps Mike Lindell, and you'll get a great product for anybody that you're shopping for. Well, welcome back, everyone. Thank you for being here with us tonight. You know, we were talking about this new film, this new movie that's out called Protocol 7, where we are incriminating finally being able to hold Merck's feet to the fire in a very public forum, which I think is just amazing. Andy, I want to ask you, as a filmmaker, because, you know, you have, you know, you were a published physician, and then you got mad and wrote some really cool books because about your experience. And then you said, okay, I'm going to take these experiences and turn them into films, because stories and stories about what we've been talking about for two decades is the best way to reach the most people. When you did this particular film, what was it like? What did you like the best about being the director of this film?
You know, it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. I'd studied direction. I'd actually worked with actors, and because as an academic, you do, you know, I don't know anything about this, so I'm going to learn and learn and learn and learn. I'm going to read every book that's ever been written. But still, when you have all these actors and the crew, and they know a lot more than you do, you've really got to convince them somehow to do your bidding. And preparation is the key. So directing is 90% preparation. Prepare. What angle do we want this camera? What lighting? How do I want the inflection to sound with this particular actor? What is their take on this line, and how can we integrate that? So you can't just wing it. You've got to prepare. And preparation is, as I say, 90% of it. So once you've done that, and you go on and you get through the first few days, it then becomes an absolute joy. It really becomes such a pleasure, because you realize that you're dealing with extremely talented people who bring something to, particularly, for example, the actors. They bring an interpretation of their own to it that you hadn't thought of. And you think, wow, that works. That's really, really good. And I'm going to get the credit as the director for that. But I didn't deserve it. And so, it was because I had such a wonderful team, the directors, sorry, the producers, the assistant director, the actors, everybody. It really was a joy to do it. I can imagine that that is not always the case, that some movies, people are temperamental and angry and egotistical. Everybody left their ego at the door, which was great. And the other thing I did is to make a point of getting everybody in the room before a particular scene. For example, the husband and wife have a major conflict, the usual conflict that you've seen millions of times, where the wife wants to do one thing and the husband wants to do another. And there is acrimony. And I say, why are we shooting this scene? I get everybody together before. What is the purpose of telling this aspect of the story? Is it just drama for drama's sake? No. There is an extraordinarily high rate of divorce amongst families where a child in that family has autism, because the people are under such extraordinary pressure, such strain, that they crack. Why does one drink too much? Why does one give up? Why does one despise doctors, whereas another might still invest their trust in them? Then we had a scene, for example, where they were cooking gluten casein free food. Why are we doing this? What is behind this diet? Is it just a fad? Is it just some crazy thing that the mother picked up on the internet? What is the background to understanding why they're going through this process? And in doing that, this never happens, apparently. I didn't know that. This doesn't happen on film sets. People come in, they do their job, and they go home. But they're not emotionally invested. If they're the lighting guy or the electrical guy, whatever they might be, they're not invested necessarily in the film. But now they really saw the purpose in everything that was going on. And in fact, three of them on the set had children who were affected, had autistic children. And we didn't have a big set. And the lead actor had a nephew who was similarly affected. So it meant something to people. And once it meant something to people, it brought the crew and the cast and everybody together in this extraordinary collaboration. And it worked very well. So it's something that I would always use in future in a film, you know, like this, because it engaged people. They felt that they were part of something bigger than themselves.
And so the educational process of like explaining gluten-free, dairy-free diets, it was not only the actors, but the film, the lighting people, the camera people, I mean, everybody was there getting that part of education of learning what this was about.
Absolutely. And some of them,
that's amazing.
Ones with affected children, someone would put there and say, yeah, that's exactly what happened. So now their own team, you know, their own crew members were acknowledging the truth behind this from their own experience. And so it had a very good effect, that one that went beyond what I'd anticipated.
You know, that is just absolutely amazing, Andy, because now the film's done and, you know, all the actors are going home and going on to other jobs, but they've learned something other than just getting in and saying their roles and memorizing their lines and, you know, doing their acting job, whatever. That educational stuff that meant something to them, they'll take with them the rest of their life. That's really, really cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it was. And we had some of the actors had pregnant wives at home. And what do we do, Andy? How should we go about this? I said, it's not my place to tell you what you should do. You should get educated. I'm not my place to tell you whether you should or shouldn't get the vaccines, but there is an abundance of information out there now that will allow you to come to a choice. And that's what happened. Many of them came to, one of my producers was just talking about how much he enjoyed your show today. So it was a wonderful sort of educational experience for them.
How was the movie named? How was it named Protocol 7?
Well, the actual Merck protocol was Protocol 007. But we thought, you know, if we called the film Protocol 007, it would just sound ridiculous. It would sound like a sort of spin-off.
Sound like a Bond movie or something, right?
Ian Fleming and James Bond. No, so we thought we cannot call it that, so we cut it down to Protocol 7.
I see. How was making this film, Protocol 7, different from making Vaxxed or from making 1986 The Act, your other two films that you've done?
Well, I think, firstly, that with a documentary, there isn't the time constraint. You know, you go and interview someone here, interview someone there, but you're not under that time pressure that we bring all these people together for a defined length of time, 6 weeks in our case, and that's as long as you've got them. Eric Roberts has got to go off and do another film. Matthew Marsden's got another film to do. We have to get it done within that time frame. So
6 weeks? You got it done in 6 weeks?
So you shoot the entire film in 6 weeks. And that's
amazing.
That was the big difference, is you're under the gun from the moment you, because every extra day spent on set is, you know, you're talking about a great deal of money. And so you have to just work within those 6 weeks. We had one half day of rain that threw us out a little bit, but we caught up and we worked late at night and that we overcame. But it's that was the big difference in terms of the sort of kinetics of making it. The practicality of making it is from day one, you're pushing right the way through, come hell or high water, to get that finished.
Let's talk for just a minute, just briefly, about, I think a lot of people that are listening to this have been following me for a long time. They've been following you for a long time, too. Let's talk just for a minute about the 1986 The Act, the other film that you did, because that film was so meaningful to me. And like I said in the introduction, I knew the story. I knew the storyline. But the way that you put it together between a husband and a wife that, you know, were trying to figure out what to do, and they'd been trying to get pregnant for a long time and they finally did, and their whole journey about that. Let's talk a little bit about how you put that one together.
Yes, we had some wonderful, you know, legal input, people who came to it from the vaccine injury compensation system and prior to that system being put in place. So they'd seen the transition, they'd seen the enactment of the 1986 Act, and they'd seen the iniquity that arose out of that. You know, that the three elements of the Act were that, you know, we should make vaccines safer for children by research, that we should compensate children fairly who have been sacrificed effectively in the name of the greater good, and we should give the industry, the vaccine makers, liability protection from death and injury caused by their vaccines, or they would go out of business, so they said. Of course, the last one succeeded so well for the industry. The other two have been catastrophic. The science has not been done. The problems continue and grow. But so I wanted to capture all of that. And then the question was how to take all of this dense factual information, because what I was trying to do there is make the definitive story about the Act. And initially, I wanted to make it as three parts because it is so dense and there's so much of it. So to do it as a series. But not only were we censored from the organizations that did series at the time, like Netflix and Amazon, but we were constrained financially. So getting the film, a three-part series out there, was going to be challenging. And so we decided to condense it down to a single film. And then how to make it engaging. And one of the most powerful elements of the drama was the conflict, as it always is in drama. You have to have conflict. And how better to characterize that conflict than the mother to do the research and say, I'm not sure about this. The father to say, well, what about polio? What about polio? And walk out of the room as though that dealt with the debate. There was no debate. What about polio? Not providing any factual content behind that statement, what about polio? But how many times have you heard that from so many people? Well, what about polio then?
And what about smallpox?
Smallpox. And then they walk off and that's it. The debate's over. And so I wanted to start right there with that sort of what about polio, and then go into the background to polio, which much of which I didn't know until I researched it and got into it with Patrick Tierney, who was wonderful. And the terrible behavior of the, you know, the saints of vaccinology in the context of polio, and it went on from there. So we built up this story that it was hugely complex. And I think I sometimes regret that it should have ended when she had the baby at the end. You know, that was the moment as a filmmaker when it should have ended. But I wanted to put in something more, and I shouldn't have done that. That was an error. So I learned from that one. Dell told me off. He made one big mistake. And that was, and he was right, absolutely right. I that was a mistake. I should have stopped it there. But nonetheless, it, I hope it stands as sort of, you know, not only a history of the act, but the definitive history of the act, with stories that most people are not aware of in there.
And that film is still available, and it can be watched where? Where can people find that?
That can be watched at 1986theact.com. So if you look, and that will be on our new website as well. So you'll be able to watch all of these movies, faxed, 1986, The Act, on protocol7.movie.
That's
so
good.
They're going to be posted up there. So please watch them. And as I say, they were made in order to do the heavy lifting for people getting into this topic and uncertain of which direction to go in. And I would recommend that you watch those movies, read the books, listen to your show and others' show, and then compare it with what the CDC website says, so that you make an informed choice in what you do for your children or recommendations you make.
Well, speaking of Dell, I heard you say on Highwire that you're not done yet. You've got a few more films in you. Are you ready to move on, or are you going to sit back and enjoy the success of Protocol 7 first?
No, I can't do that. I should. I'm
like, no, you can't do. He can't I'm do like, which part?
I can't sit still. I have a screenplay written that I want to get on and make just as soon as possible. We were never going to do a Wuhan story. Sort of, we were never going to do a COVID story, because there'll be 2,000 people in Hollywood writing that screenplay right now. I just didn't want to get into that melee of, but it's actually self-correcting. The truth is becoming so wonderfully clear. Absolute tragedy, but the truth of Fauci's behavior and Daszak's behavior and everything, there, it's becoming so abundantly clear to everyone now that you can produce an unambiguous story, but still have all of the intrigue that led up to it, the deception, the lies, the really the profiteering. That, so I kind of got drawn into, yes, we'll make a story, but we have a very unusual angle from which to tell it. And that's, for me, the key, is to take something that people didn't expect and weave a story around that also brings in all these other elements. So that's something we're working on at the moment in terms of putting pen to paper.
Wow. Well, that shouldn't surprise me, because you don't let any moss grow under your feet, and never have, ever since I've met you. And I've known you since the early 2000s. So it's been a joy to watch everything that you've done and to follow in your footsteps, because you're a giant in our industry and now in filmmaking, Andy. And I'm so proud to call you my friend. I think it's wonderful.
Well, I thank you. It means a great deal.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us here tonight, and joining us to talk about this new movie that's coming out. You know, protocol7.movie is the place where people can go and see where it's going to be released. You can get on your newsletter so you can get more information for that. As the new website gets built, you'll be able to watch all the other films that Andy has done. So I want to thank you so much, Andy, for being here with us tonight. And I'm glad to know that you're back in Austin. I was just there like 2 weeks ago. I didn't know that you were in town. That would have been nice to have crossed paths with you. So thank you so much for joining us here for tonight. And I want to thank all of my listeners who come on Monday night to hear here at Bridie on TV for our show. And I want to close with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close all my broadcasts with, whether they are live or pre-recorded, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, remember to lean into God, trust Him for everything. He'll never let you down. Andy, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. Thank you for everyone who's joined us. And we will see you here next week, same place, same time, at Timpani Files on Your Health. Have a good night, have a great week, and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com, and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.